Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but it just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to talk about the Mediterranean diet and how it can impact the health of a baby, and how garlic can boost your cardiovascular health. And Penn State University does a study showing the good cholesterol functions to lower risk of later heart disease. We'll show you how to do that. Also, a lot more evidence from Norwegian University of Science that increasing your dietary fiber reduces the risk of developing diabetes. And mega doses of vitamin D can decrease the hospital stays and critical care. That's Emory University. And also, we are a nation suffering from an epidemic of autoimmune disease, and it severely impacts people. Fatigue, pain, physical limitations. What can we do to prevent it? Also, those of you taking the new contraceptive pills, University of Nottingham, United Kingdom, published in the British Medical Journal, you increase your risk of blood clots, and that increased your risk of death. That and a lot more coming up on our health and nutrition segment. And then I'm sure many of you have concerns about the type of people who have an inordinate amount of input into our lives, the technocrats. The technocrats are individuals who have mastered at a high level of proficiency something that we give them an enormous amount of reward for and credit and praise. But there's a downside to being a technocrat, and I'll discuss that. Our mania for hope is a curse. Chris Hedges, Truth Out. Privatization has been a colossal flop. Benefits the rich but hurts the public interest. Dr. Alan Francis, Psychology Today. How trade agreements amount to a secret corporate takeover. Professor Joseph Stiglitz. And also, Boeing unveils an amazing, slightly terrifying new electromagnetic pulse weapon. Why should we be concerned? Because this could be put into a police department where they simply turn this on you and totally disable you. And it has terrible possibilities. And the plane is made. Now let's see what they use it on. Also, Israel orders more than 11,000 demolitions in the West Bank. Why aren't we saying anything about this? And a new human papillomavirus vaccine study, quote, increases the chance of developing other human papillomavirus strains. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Scott Scheer. He is an expert in the science and use of hyperbaric oxygen medicine. He graduated magna cum laude from University of Maryland School of Medicine, and he is one of America's leading authorities on oxygen therapy. So today, the science health benefits of oxygen therapy by an orthodox physician who is its biggest supporter, and what it can do if you have chronic fatigue, cancer, stroke, post-traumatic stress disorder, brain injuries. We'll get into all that. If we have time, we'll get into everything, and I have a lot more I want to share. But let's start with something that we can all benefit from, eating better. This is from the Institute of Pharmacological Research in Italy. Quote, women who eat a Mediterranean diet could cut their risk of womb cancer by more than 57%. And that was published in the British Journal of Cancer. Now, what does this mean in lay language? Well, they took 5,000 Italian women to see how closely they stuck to a Mediterranean diet and whether or not they then developed womb cancer. And they had, there's 9 components they looked at, like the number of fruits, the number of vegetables, the number and type of nuts, and pulses. Those are your legumes, which in the Mediterranean area, you can't go a meal without getting pulses or legumes in soups. Well, here we might have a lentil soup. In India, they have a dal soup, which is also made from lentils. But they have all kinds of whole grain cereals, meaning they don't process a grain into a powder as we do. They eat it as a whole grain. They have lots of potatoes, a lot of variety of potatoes, fish out of the Mediterranean. And they also looked at, they had very little intake of meat and milk. And by the way, I never saw, now maybe in your travels you have, and I can only speak for myself, and that was of all my visits to people in Italy, in the country, in the suburbs, in the cities, when they used, let's say, at the beginning of a meal, they might have olives on a dish or a whole bread. It was always olive oil that they would put seasonings in. Here we use butter. Didn't see that butter being used there. Not they don't use any butter, but it's a different type of butter. Their milk is a different type of milk also. In the country, you get that real thick cream milk. Now, I remember that when I was growing up. First on the farm, you could get it right out of the cow, and then, but in the little town, the mailman, a milkman would come by, and in a little box, he would put however much milk that you ordered. And I'd look at this, and on top was always the cream, and it was sweet. And that's what my mom would make different dishes with. So we never knew about homogenized milk. And homogenization in and of itself is a contributing factor to heart disease. So they looked at all these things, and they found that those who stuck to six of those things reduced their risk of womb cancer by 46%. So could you imagine then if they also included exercise, stress management, and taking anti-cancer supplements, or even in the diet, the cruciferous vegetables? Now, I believe that every American should be consuming cruciferous vegetables every day, ideally fresh, organic from your local farmer's market. That is the ideal. And broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, collard greens, kale, watercress, mustard greens, radishes, those are all filled with sulfur and the indole-3 carbonyls and cyanates. These help kill cancer cells. And there's hundreds of studies to show that. So it didn't measure that. There's a common dish that you will find in the country, not in the cities of Europe. It's called purslane. Now, you have large purslane, you have small purslane. It grows wild everywhere. And if you ask the shepherds, and there you actually will see shepherds. You don't see them in the United States. You'll see a farmer that will have goats or sheep or cattle or horses. But there you'll actually see over, you know, a large rocky mountainous terrain, you'll see the sheep and you'll see a herder. And you also see this in the Middle East. And you ask them, what is the healthiest thing they can have? And they have five or six wild bitters. And they eat these, and purslane is one. So the next time you go to the farmer's market, it's in season now, ask for purslane. And try to get the smaller one. The smaller one is crunchy on the outside, has a nice, cool quality when it's in a salad. And you chop the stem and the leaf up. It's delicious, but it's very, very healing. Now, garlic is another thing is healing. I recommend garlic in very high amounts, depending upon what a person is trying to do with their health. For example, if you had terminal cancer, I would have you juicing more garlic than in one day than you would eat in a year. I'm talking about enormous amounts, staggering amounts. And then, of course, you're not going to have much of a social life, but if you're terminally ill, the likelihood is you're not out dancing. Most of the time, people are in bed or hospice care. But what you're doing is you're turning on the natural killer cell activity. The sulfur is good if you have cancer. And by combining onions and garlic together, it is phenomenally powerful. It's a detoxifier, kills bacteria and viruses. including people who didn't even think about their arthritis or fibromyalgia because they had the cancer to focus on. And now one day, about 3 weeks into a program, they say, gee whiz, you know, I don't have that arthritis pain anymore. Well, what turns off inflammation in one part of the body turns off inflammation in every cell of the body. That's why when you have garlic and onions in juice form, and you have to dilute it, it's hard to take, and you have to start by so much water and then less garlic and onion, and then each day you increase the garlic and onion and decrease the water till you really get it concentrated. And then it's doing an amazing job of killing cancer cells and stimulating the immune system. There are thousands of articles on the healing power of garlic. This is the latest one. This is from National Taiwan University. And here's what it says, quote, allicin from garlic may prevent the metabolism of unabsorbed L-carnitine or choline into TMAO, a compound linked to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So what this means is that garlic compounds may boost cardio health indirectly via your gut, meaning it allows you to have healthier bacteria. Now remember, you have 10 times more bacteria than you have cells. So you're talking about hundreds of trillion of bacteria. When you eat sugar, you drink alcohol, when you have fried meats, when you have any meats, you increase the bad bacteria. But when you eat healthy and living in raw foods, you are promoting good bacteria. And when you take your probiotics or ORAC, you're super potentizing your good bacteria. So what is the connection between garlic and your heart? Well, first, we know from many studies, garlic will lower blood pressure. Garlic thins your blood. Before I go on a flight, I always take 6 garlic, black garlic capsules. I take a whole regimen before I'm on the flight, and then every 2 hours of the flight, I take more because it keeps the blood thin and your blood oxygenated to prevent stroke and thrombosis on those flights, which are very common. But it also adds to the scientific literature supporting the potential health heart benefits of garlic. And there, what we have found is it helps protect the epithelium, the lining of your arteries. So get your garlic in. Also, the largest ever prospective study adds to the evidence that the good HDL function is more important than the HDL level. The University of Pennsylvania, quote, HDL is the good cholesterol that helps remove fat from artery walls, reversing the process that leads to heart disease. Yet recent drug trials and genetic studies suggest that simply pushing HDL levels higher doesn't necessarily reduce the risk of heart disease. Now a team led by scientists from Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania has shown in a large forward-looking epidemiological study that a person's HDL function, the efficiency of HDL molecules at removing cholesterol, may be a better measure of coronary heart disease risk and a better target for heart-protecting drugs. And so that's what it's saying. So what then do we know? We know that when we exercise, we increase the HDL. When we have a plant-based diet, we increase the HDL. When we have L-carnitine, hawthorn, vitamin E, and vitamin C, we can increase the HDL. That means you're helping protect your heart. And finally, a new study from Norwegian University of Science and published in an international journal of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes indicates that consuming greater quantities of dietary fiber, I suggest around 40 grams a day to 50, reduces the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Now, diabetes is massive. There's 360 million people worldwide that have diagnosed diabetes, and at least 5 times that amount who have undiagnosed prediabetes. So you're dealing with over 1.5 billion people who have adverse reactions. And so getting diabetes reversed is crucial. And what they found was it's the fiber. Get your fiber. Fiber is crucial. And by the way, from Emory University, hospitalized patients often have insufficient levels of vitamin D because of a lack of physical activity and exposure to the sun. And vitamin D, we know, increases the ability of immune cells to fight infection. So in this particular randomized clinical trial, those that received 500,000, half a million units of vitamin D each day for 5 days, compared to those received a placebo, it made a huge difference. Quote, these dosages were significantly higher than normal daily doses and were extended to quickly restore vitamin D levels in patients who have low levels. And it made a difference. Now, you could take 5,000 units a day, and that could make a difference in helping your immune system. So the bottom line here, takeaway message, make sure you're getting into the sun. Make sure you're getting your vitamin D, and that will help your immune system. I'm Gary Noll, and that's our health and nutrition segment. Now, I'm going to intersperse several things today that will make a difference here. And one is, a lot of people don't recognize that we're, as a school teacher, I'm a teacher. I teach now. I've taught most of my adult life, New School for Social Research, Pratt Institute, School of Visual Arts, City University of New York and its program, and Fairleigh Dickinson University. I'm always sharing what I can in continuing education or credit courses, whatever they may be. But it's crucial for all teachers to stop and ask the learner, the student, what are you learning? Do you believe this is helping you? Does the information and how I'm presenting it in this course, does it help you have better faculty of judgment, to be more critical in your thinking? And if it's not, if it's just helping them to take tests and pass tests, then I consider that a worthless proposition. We are over-tested, we are over-studied for tests, and we're completely under-educated for the real world that we all have to face each day and our children will face in the future. I want you to hear about the truth about schools. It's short, it's only 2 minutes long, but I think it's something we could benefit from.
Let's talk about education. In most Western countries, school is compulsory and state-enforced. Truancy can result in fines or even jail time for parents. This isn't just a result of state coercion. On a cultural level, education holds a sacred status, much like that of religion. This is an institution that most never question, and that's a problem. Did you ever wonder how it is that kids spend 13 years from kindergarten to high school supposedly being prepared for life, yet when they get out, they don't have any real skills? 13 years and kids aren't taught how to grow a garden, how to build a house, how to fix a car, how to balance a checkbook, or how to cook a healthy meal. 13 years and kids come out without even rudimentary concepts of how to organize or lead groups of people, without even a glimmer of understanding of how to resolve conflicts nonviolently. And we call this an education? Yes, we're taught how to read and write and to perform some basic math, but we aren't taught how to think for ourselves. We aren't taught the principles of logic or how to question an ideology. What we are taught is how to sit in a desk and listen obediently as the world is packaged into a neat little box that we are to accept without question. We're taught to regurgitate that information for tests, to give the answer that those in authority demand. But most of all, we're conditioned to conform. And the reward for faithfully jumping through all of these hoops for 13 years is a worthless piece of paper that no employer even asked to see. Kids exit high school barely qualified to flip burgers at McDonald's. And even for that, they have to be trained. 13 years is a long time. That's most of our childhood. To have this much time taken by force with such pathetic results is unacceptable. The problem here isn't a lack of funding. The problem here isn't poorly trained teachers, lax regulations, or low-quality curriculum. The problem is our entire educational paradigm. The system isn't designed to prepare children for the real world. It's designed to format their minds and condition them for a life of subservience. It's designed to create a population of individuals just smart enough to fill out paperwork and punch a time card, but too stupid to question the system itself or the authority of those running it. If we want to change course, we cannot ignore this aspect of our enslavement. There's no point laboring to wake up other adults in our lives if we send our children to be programmed by the state. The revolution of the mind must include a revolution in education. If this is a message you feel the public needs to hear, then be sure to like, favorite, and share this video through as many avenues as possible. If you want more videos like this, be sure to subscribe to this channel, Storm Clouds Gathering, on YouTube. For updates and bonus content, follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/stormcloudsgathering, on Twitter at Collapse Updates, and our website, stormcloudsgathering.com.
Okay, now, that's just something for us to consider. All I'm doing is trying to stimulate a dialogue on what is the real purpose of education, and can we make it better for the student? Now, we're going to share another short clip here about why we lost in California. We've been losing on the genetic engineering front. We've been losing on the vaccine mandatory in California, but they want to make it in all 50 states, and they want to make it for adults. Remember this. And when recently Bonnie Faulkner invited me to share what I know about vaccines, having testified under oath, having led demonstrations, having written 34 articles, done 3 award-winning documentaries, I have a pretty good knowledge of the safety and efficacy issues based upon real science, not opinion. Because if someone could invent a vaccine that could help prevent disease and prove that it was not injurious or was safe, I would support it in a heartbeat. But I haven't found that to be the case. The trouble is, when we stop at the illusion and trust the technocrats, we've created this pill to help you, take it, and don't question us. Well, that's exactly the point we should start questioning. When we do, as I just answered a response this morning from one of our supporters of this station meaning we're carried on stations all over the world, but one of our sister stations for 39 years every day is WBI in New York, and Mitchell Cohen, who was helping be a part of a protest against the war, sent me a mail from where he and some others were incarcerated for, I think he said, 45 days. Well, congratulations to you, Mitch, because those 45 days that you are incarcerated show that you had the courage, the character, and the strength of spirit to stand up for something, realizing there would be a sacrifice. So when people don't realize what they are sacrificing by not standing up, and then you realize how insignificant an incarceration in a jail for a day or a week or a month or 2 months is compared to what we lose if we don't. We lose our clean air, we lose our society, we lose the Fourth Amendment, we lose our First Amendment, we lose our Second Amendment, which we should never lose. Though you don't ask that on the left because they're clueless about other revolutions that they have lost it. And let us remind people of Mao and Stalin and Hitler. And I don't trust this government at all, because I know what they're capable of. And for those who protest, they do too. So it's an acknowledgement that you know the real issues and you're willing to make a sacrifice. The average American's not enough pain. They're angry. They're complaining. They're whining. They got hemorrhoids. They're obese. They got diseases that they contributed to, but they're not willing to stop. They're not willing to stop voting for these clowns or buying in their superstores or watching their television or listening to the radio or buying their sneakers, or buying their dresses. So if you're not in that kind of pain, or if you're not in that much of enlightenment, then you're going to suffer consequences. Unfortunately, no one wants to see that. So in any case, in California, our sister station, not my sister station, you know, if this was the sister, man, this is a bad sister, KPFA, they banned us. They censored us. Now remember that. Free speech radio is the only place you're guaranteed, if they don't like your ideology or politics or anything about you, they'll ban you. They'll censor you. And then they have the temerity to go on the air and ask for money? Well, excuse me, take a look. You have no ratings at any Pacifica station. In fact, so low, you have in the low hundreds in prime time. And how you doing with that fundraising? You aren't. You have to reduce your budgets from $1.1 million to $600,000. Now you've only got $300,000. Did it ever occur to you that you've got utterly wrong management, some bad programming, and local station boards filled, in my personal opinion, with provocateurs and saboteurs, and no one seems bright enough to figure that out? So it's over. When you become completely and totally irrelevant to the important social issues of the time, don't look outside for the blame. So this is why, one of the reasons we lost in California. Listen in. It's a short but important piece.
Wonder how laws really get made in California? Let's find out.
It's time to reveal one of the capital's best-kept secrets. Sponsored bills.
Yes, if you're a lawmaker in Sacramento, you need never touch pen to paper. Lobbyists and outside interest groups can do the work for you.
But I thought regular people got their state legislator to write bills for them.
Get with the times, little scamp. Interest groups can write just the bill they want, then pick their favorite legislator to put his or her name on it. We're talking lobbyists, corporations, unions, associations, nonprofits, for-profits, groups with money and political muscle who want to see their very own bill become a law. Sure, some bills are written in the traditional way, by a lawmaker, but we don't know how many, because lawmakers aren't even required to say whether a bill is sponsored. So we don't really know who is behind many of these bills. A bill could be sponsored by the Association of Pothole Manufacturers and introduced by State Senator Joe Sacto. Or Joe Sacto could just say he wrote it entirely by himself. No one has to know who actually wrote the bill. Transparency schmansparency. There are all kinds of sponsored bills.
And also bills that may or may not be sponsored, depending on what a lawmaker's interpretation of sponsorship is at a given time on a given day.
You don't have to know, right? What we do know is that interest groups always have bills to feed lawmakers. And some lawmakers seek out bills written by interest groups. Remember, Joe Sacto need never touch pen to paper.
Joe Sacto may sometimes touch pen to paper. We just don't know.
And with over 2,000 registered lobbyists in California, Joe's friends just might come in handy when he's looking for campaign contributions. Do voters really need to know who is actually writing the laws in the great state of California? Who cares? We've got sponsored bills to introduce.
Sponsored bills may or may not be designated as sponsored. Lawmakers are under no obligation to reveal a bill's true author. Voters are subject to having their laws written by unelected individuals or interest groups.
And had I had an opportunity to actually be on the station, then they would have known, the listeners would have known, and there are some very progressive listeners, that I had the amount of money for every one of the legislators who was supporting the legislations for mandated vaccines, plus the previous mandated vaccine of Gardasil and how much each one received, plus the $500,000 that the lead sponsor had received from pharmaceutical interest and named each one the pharmaceutical interest. Now, here's what's of interest. In the state of California, these legislators signed a law that states that they cannot receive more than $250 and then lobby on behalf of someone who gives them more money. You can't do that. So why aren't the people of California asking the Attorney General of California to investigate if any of these legislators indeed broke the law? And therefore, they would have to recuse themselves on voting for something where they have received $1,500, $3,100, $2,800, $1,500, $2,000, $2,000, $2,000. I have all the names of all the legislators. I have how much they voted for. Now, interesting, no one at KPFA seemed to care or find this of interest. All they knew was people like myself don't represent the kind of information they want to have on their air. That's fine. Hey, free speech radio, you can kill everyone's free speech. You have that right to do it, and you've done it many times. Your program directors have done it, and others have done it. So why do you think nobody listens to you anymore, and you're struggling to survive, and it's only going to get worse? But, hey, you are terminally ill, but you're exuberantly healthy. Is that an oxymoron, a contradiction? When you're worth $200 million with all your non-commercial and commercial licenses, someone's going to end up selling BAI, PFW, and KPFT, and have a lot of money that they can do what they want with in game. And people just didn't see it coming. Well, those of us at BAI, we saw it coming. So that's how bills get passed in California. Oh, and in New York, in every state in America. The other day I saw a movie. It's a small movie. It's a movie that is almost claustrophobic. Most of the movie takes place either in a tiny little, what looks like a shipping container that's actually a drone command center, where about five or six people sit around consoles and they're told to watch certain individuals over in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, wherever it is. And then they're given a command to kill them. And when they do a kill, they call it a clean kill or a good kill. And that was the title of the film with what's-his-face, Nathan Hawke. It's written well, it's acted well, but it's most importantly, it's based on a true story about what really goes on. And then how the CIA comes in there, and they don't care how many people they kill. So the film has two parts. The first one, they're just watching all day, you know, to see is a targeted person going into a compound, and is it them, and can they verify it, and not doing anything if there's citizens nearby. And then the CIA takes over, and they say, kill him. And one of the people says in the middle of the film, isn't that a war crime? And he says, you've been given an order. And then the idea is, these are all technocrats. When given an order, they must follow it. They're not allowed to have a moral compass that allows them to ask, is this right or wrong? Should I or should I not? You're told to do something, you better do it. Now, when we look today at what we become a corporatized state where people who are in private contracts with the federal government, they privatize our defense, our security, and they've overdone it to such a degree that now we, all American citizens who speak out on any issue, are considered domestic terrorists. And for those of us who speak out against corporate interest, we're at the top of their list. So the question is, why aren't there people working within administrations or government agencies or major corporations in policy-making positions or opinion-leading positions who have the moral courage to say, we should not be doing this. This is not right. We shouldn't be collecting all this mass data. It's against the law. But you don't have that. Where is the person in the SWAT team who barges in on an 82-year-old man 2 days ago and who's in bed and roughs him up? Where's the one who says, hey, fella, there's an 82-year-old man in his underwear in bed. Do we really need to beat him up and punch him? Do we need to do that? But you don't have one of those men in any SWAT team in America. What you have is you have people being killed, dogs being killed, innocent people being killed, running your shot in the back. What was it, 132 bullets in a car where they were unarmed, but claiming they felt threatened, so therefore it justified, and they were let off. We have a culture of technocrats run by, who manage bureaucrats, who are run by autocrats, and who are controlled by the oligarch. That's a bad combination, and yet we seem to be disconnected from that reality. But not Chris Hedges. I had him on yesterday. I hope you enjoyed listening to what he had to say. That is just the beginning. The naive belief that history is linear, that moral progress accompanies technical progress, that's a form of collective self-delusion. It cripples our capacity for radical action and lulls us into a false sense of security. Now, in my travels around the United States, I see people who are struggling. Farmers who are out of water and watching their fields go fallow and their animals die. People who have had to move away from their homes because they don't have the money to dig deep. And even if they did dig deep, they don't know if they'd hit water. You have people living in cities who have everything in the world immediately at their disposal. From the greatest culture and arts and entertainment and restaurants and fashion, neighborhoods and parks. They would never imagine what it's like in the last week to be in Austin and Houston and San Antonio and other cities in Texas that are simply being washed away. Thousands of people affected, millions affected, because it's not on their radar. And only those who accept the very real possibility of dystopia, of the rise of a ruthless corporate totalitarianism, buttressed by the most terrifying security and surveillance apparatus in human history, are likely to carry out the self-sacrifice necessary for revolt. And different people revolt in different ways. I mentioned Mitchell Cohen, very courageous. He revolted by protesting. he paid a price, but he knew he would pay a price. No one is so naive when you go into a protest, as peaceful as it may be, as nonviolent as you are, to assume that there won't be a price to pay, but you say it's worth it, because at least I stood up. But where were all the other people who did not stand up to their neighbors being forced out of their homes and home foreclosure? Why didn't they go and say, could I help your friend? Is there anything I can do in this moment? But they didn't. So tens of millions of Americans watched 6 million of their neighbors moved out and the Japanese lock up their house and the banks wrote it off at 100% tax deduction, then got bailed out and then turned around and retrenched them into rental properties. It's a game. But we choose to stay a part of the game instead of challenging it. The yearning for positivism that pervades our corporate culture ignores human nature and human history. But to challenge it, to state the obvious fact that things are getting worse and may soon get much worse, is to be tossed out of the circle of magical thinking that defines America and much of the Western culture. The left is infected with its mania for hope as the right. Doubt me, watch MSNBC, a pathetic excuse, or what I call wonder brain, wonder bread for the brain, and that is NPR. This is a mania that obscures reality even as global capitalism disintegrates and the ecosystem unravels, potentially affecting all of us. The 19th century theorist Louis Auguste Blanquet, unlike nearly all of his contemporaries, dismissed the belief central to Karl Marx that human history is a linear progression towards equality and greater morality. He warned that this absurd positivism is the lie perpetrated by oppressors. He said, quote, "All atrocities of the victor, the long service of his attacks, are coldly transformed into constant, inevitable evolution like that of nature. But the sequence of human things is not inevitable like that of the universe. It can be changed at any moment." Yes, he was right. He foresaw that scientific and technological advancement, rather than being a harbinger of progress, could be a, quote, "a terrible weapon in the hands of capital against work and thought." And in a day when few others did so, he decried the despoiling of the natural world. He said, "The axe fells and nobody replants. There's no concern for the future ill health." Well, how about this? Why don't you go into California, a desert, and in 80% of the state, and why don't you see, even as we speak, new developments where developers are completely destroying whatever natural environment is there, trees, shrubs, to put in another golf course, another gated community, that's going to require massive amounts of water at the very time when they're out of water. An unusual concept? Not at all, if you're not willing as the buyer to look at the consequences, or as the seller, and as a result, what is this called? What Banquet said was, it is never stationary. It advances or goes backwards. Its progressive march leads it to its end. Well, he understood that history has long periods of cultural barrenness and brutal repression. I believe we're in one of those now. The fall of the Roman Empire, for example, led to misery throughout Europe during the Dark Ages, roughly from the 6th through the 13th century. There was a loss of technological knowledge. For example, they didn't know how to maintain or build aqueducts. And a culture and intellectual impoverishment led to vast historical amnesia that blotted out the greatest thinkers and artists of the classical world. None of this loss was regained until the 14th century, when Europe saw the beginning of the Renaissance, a development made possible largely by the cultural flourishing of Islam, which through translating Aristotle into Arabic and other intellectual accomplishments kept alive the knowledge and wisdom of the past. The Dark Ages were marked by arbitrary rule. Incessant wars, we have that. Insecurity, we have that. Anarchy, we have that. And terror, oh, do we have that. And I see nothing to prevent the rise of a new dark age if we do not abolish the corporate state. What does that mean? It means doing what is obvious to anyone who cares. Take away the charters and have them on a renewable basis based upon outside independent review. Have you violated the public trust? Have you created anything with intent that will cause a reduction of the life of the planet or people or animals? If you have, then your charter is gone. You're bankrupt. 90% of America's major corporations then would be bankrupt. As it is now, they can lie, cheat, steal, murder, kill, and no one is held accountable because they're protected behind the corporate charter. If you really want a new world, take away the charters and allow them only on a basis that they're maintained yearly. Then see if the only motive for any corporate interest is profit. Knowledge does not lead to wisdom. Knowledge is more often a tool for repression. Knowledge through a careful selection and manipulation of facts gives a false unity to reality. It creates a fictitious collective memory and narrative. It manufactures abstract concepts of honor and glory and heroism and duty and destiny that buttress the power of the state, feed the disease of nationalism and call for blind obedience in the name of patriotism. It allows human beings to explain the advances and reverses in human achievement and morality, as well as the process of birth and decay in the natural world as parts of a vast movement forward in time. The collective enthusiasm for manufactured national and personal narratives in which a form of self-exaltation bolts out reality, the myth we create that fosters a fictitious hope and false sense of superiority, are celebrations of ourselves. This mocks wisdom, but it keeps people passive. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to our guest, Dr. Scott Scheer, in a moment to talk about the science and health benefits of oxygen therapy, but just two little program announcements. One is, I had mentioned last week that after 2 years' absence, Nadia was coming back for a brief period of time to help counsel people for free. She's paid a very nice salary. I pay all of the people who counsel others for free, because I only am able to work with terminally ill people. So for everyone else, well, I try to provide a quality credentialed staff. Now, I mentioned, let me just tell you what she is. She is not a medical doctor. She's a PhD in psychology. She graduated top of her class at Albert Einstein School of Medicine and top of her class at Yeshiva University. And she just finished 2 years of getting her certification, and now she goes for her board, and then she's board certified, and then we probably won't have her services anymore because she'll be very busy. But in the interim, she's been very gracious to help those that she can, and she has enormous capability of helping people. She also speaks multiple languages, including Arabic. So if you want free counseling, but she's not a medical doctor, but if you have problems of anxiety and depression and overeating, or she is certainly able to help you to get on a healthy diet. She's outstanding. All right? You can call and come to see her for free. Call 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000. And also, I'm just going to make a real brief announcement now. But my new feature film that I've been working on quietly, in secret, haven't mentioned it at all, is now ready for its world premiere. I'm going to do it one evening as a benefit for WBAI, our sister station in New York, to help it in its fund drive. It will be June 17th, write that down, 6 p.m. in the evening. Now, why 6? Because a lot of people can make it in from the suburbs at 6 and then get home in a reasonable time. But also, if it fills up, then we'll have another show behind it starting at 8 o'clock. You're going to receive two copies of the film itself. That's an $80 value, plus the film, plus the discussion afterwards, and all for $30. That's it. And this is a fundraiser. And here's the theme of the film: saving the world, one bite at a time. You will see people in the film that you have not seen before. You will see footage from all over the world. And it is, artistically, it is probably the most beautiful film I've ever filmed. But informationally, wow. Recently, there was the one person I haven't been able to get because he is so difficult to reach. He's in Australia, but I finally got him in Los Angeles. So And one morning, he was filmed, and wow, wow. When you see this man and how he speaks and how he says things, it's like the whole film is filled with philosophers. If you could just imagine the poetry of hearing people talk about saving the planet, very positive, very uplifting, very, very honest insights. And with all the filming that I do, the latest film, by the way, I'm going to be at the Hoboken International Film Festival because Poverty Inc., my newest film, which is just out 3 months, it's one of the finalists for Best Film Documentary of the Year. In any case, I'll give you more information on that in case anybody want to come since it's nearby, New York City. But if you want to come to the world premiere, my new film that's only going to be premiered one night as a fundraiser for WBAI, call this number, 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. And if it's busy, please be patient. It's only $30, and you get two copies of the film. And it starts at 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 17th, okay? The title of the film is Saving the Planet, One Bite at a Time. Been working on it a long time. It's done. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest standing by, Dr. Scott Scheer. I gave you his background earlier. He graduated with honors at UCLA and magna cum laude graduate from University of Maryland School of Medicine. And he has received awards of excellence in the practice of internal medicine. And he is the medical director at the San Francisco Institute for Hyperbaric Medicine and more recently became the medical advisor for the Hyperbaric Medical Solutions, a state-of-the-art treatment facility in New York City. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
I would like to focus a bit on hyperbaric oxygen therapy's efficacy, especially for infectious diseases. And right now, Lyme's disease is rapidly becoming an epidemic in the United States. And although it is worse in the Northeast, including New York tri-state area, it's also spreading through the other states. I will need to do a special just on Lyme's because there is now a great deal of denial among federal health authorities and particularly factions of the insurance industry that the disease actually exists, believe it or not. And there seems to be no viable drug treatment for Lyme's aside from massive doses of an extra powerful antibiotic. So share a little bit about what you know of Lyme's disease and what has been your experience with treating it hyperbarically.
Sure, Gary, I'd be happy to. I think it might benefit your listeners to listen a little bit about how hyperbaric therapy is working to understand how we think Lyme disease may be treated in a hyperbaric chamber, at least as part of a treatment regimen. A hyperbaric therapy really has two stimulus. It's oxygen and pressure. It's the pressure that actually drives oxygen into our cells, into our body, at superphysiologic levels, more than our body can do on its own, at sea level. And it's increasing the amount of oxygen in our body that really allows a cascade of effects to occur. These include things like angiogenesis, the formation of new blood vessels, the production of stem cells from our bone marrow, and migration to areas of injury. It also optimizes what's called cellular metabolism, or the ability of our cells to produce ATP, which is the energy currency of our cells. It also is an anti-infective, and this is where we get to Lyme, because in a sense, any bacteria or any bug that does not like a high oxygen environment is not going to like a very, very high level of oxygen being thrown at it in your body. So hyperbaric therapy is used in conjunction with antibiotics, very commonly actually, in some FDA-approved indications for hyperbaric therapy like necrotizing fasciitis or flesh-eating bacteria, to name a couple others, but that's the main one. And so we know that hyperbaric therapy works directly against bacteria, actually like Lyme disease, like the Lyme bug, which is called a facultative anaerobe. What that means is that the organism, the Lyme organism itself, likes to live in a low oxygen environment. So if you use hyperbaric therapy to treat Lyme disease, what you're doing is really directly killing the Lyme bug itself. And we see that in my office, in my clinic, and in hyperbaric clinics around the country, something that happens when patients are in the clinic, something called the Jang-Herzheimer reaction, where patients get severely sick or get a lot of pain related to die-off because of the Lyme organism. Now, I should mention also, though, that, you know, Lyme disease is, it takes a multidisciplinary approach. And as you mentioned, it's not only in New York, in California, where I practice as well, in Marin and Northern California area, it's very, very prominent as well. I work with Lyme-literate physicians and naturopaths in conjunction with hyperbaric therapy, along with really good detoxification protocols. We do see significant improvements in these patients. But again, it's a multidisciplinary approach.
What are the other conditions that you have seen respond well to oxygen therapy?
Well, they fall into two categories. The first category would be the ones that are approved by insurance companies right now. Those would be something very, very important, I think, to what you were speaking about before, about diabetes, diabetic foot ulcers. We have a remarkable ability to heal these ulcers before the need for amputations. In fact, there have been many studies over the last 20 years, but especially in the last 5 or 10, that show how effective hyperbaric therapy can be to prevent major amputations of limbs. What we can do is heal up these ulcers before the need to go and cut things off. So very dramatically effective. Other indications include radiation injuries. So patients that have gotten therapy for cancer with radiation can sometimes get these pretty severe or sometimes mild to moderate effects from the cancer radiation itself. These can include things like if it was prostate cancer, severe pain on urinating or severe pain on defecating or chronic blood in the urine. If it's a breast cancer patient, chronic non-healing wounds in the breast area from reconstructions. And down the line, as far as any other types of radiation, where it might be, there can be an effect. And what hyperbaric therapy can do is really regrow the vascular bed that's been obliterated by the radiation and get new stem cells to the area and regenerate it. There's also chronic bone infections. On the other side, I mean, non-FDA approved yet, but a lot of good data. Lyme disease is one of those. There's also traumatic brain injury, both mild to moderate as well as severe and acute traumatic brain injury. Some very exciting things going on in this world. We're doing a lot of great work with veterans coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And another really prominent indication for us right now is patients post-stroke. There is a really great group of researchers in Israel. I'm sure you're not surprised that most of this research has been being done outside of the country. But they have a very large center in Tel Aviv, and they're treating many patients and churning out studies. In fact, I just read a study this morning on chronic fatigue syndrome and hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Some other indications include reflex sympathetic dystrophy, cerebral palsy, some really good data coming out of India, actually, there. In the end, if there's a wound, hyperbaric therapy will heal it quicker and potentially more effectively than the body can do it itself, especially if it's in the brain. And the aspect of anti-infective, as I mentioned, has to do with the direct oxygen effect on the bacterial organism, as well as working with antibiotics or other types of therapies.
Last question. How long do you normally see that it takes? How many treatments and what duration of treatment, an hour, before you begin to see results?
So the protocol a little bit depends on what the indication is. The more the acute indication, the more recent the injury, the more of the less therapy that is needed. The idea really is that hyperbaric therapy is a cumulative process. It takes time for therapy to work, especially if there's been a chronic injury. So the protocols usually range anywhere between 5 treatments to 40, sometimes more. And these treatments are usually done in succession, so Monday through Friday with the weekend off. This is because the way hyperbaric therapy is working, it's actually modulating our DNA and protein transcription. We know that at least 8,000 genes in our body are pressure sensitive and oxygen sensitive. And we know that we're upregulating genes that are responsible for growth and repair and downregulating genes that are responsible for inflammation, programmed cell death. So all of that takes time. You think maximum angiogenesis, or the maximum amount of blood vessel growth that we can do, happens somewhere around 20 treatments in succession. So that's 1 month of therapy with the weekends off. Lyme disease, because that's, you know, I understand why there's such a big interest now And it is great, as you mentioned, that there are some individuals in some societies that are now looking at Lyme disease as chronic Lyme disease is actually existing, which is great. Lyme disease, 40 treatments, usually at the minimum, in a hyperbaric chamber. Each chamber length is between 60 minutes and 90 minutes. The 60-minute length is usually for neurologic indications, indications like stroke, traumatic brain injury, TBI.
Good. And finally, I just have one last quick answer I need from you because we're running out of time. How much does it cost per therapy?
So the cost depends on if insurance is going to cover it or not. If it's an insurance-related condition, it should be covered by your insurance. If it's a not, if it's not insurance, it really depends on where you are in the country. The range depends a little bit on the type of chamber that's being used. And here what I'm talking about is what are called hard chamber hyperbaric oxygen therapy. That's really the mainstay of hyperbaric therapy, just to make that clear.
And what would one therapy cost, one session?
So one session could cost anywhere between, if you're in Texas, $120, to someplace in New York City or in New York, upwards around in the middle 200, depending. But to say that most places will treat patients and make they try to do everything they can to treat these patients because we know we can help. So they do look for ways to help. In
Good.
New York, I know that they do that especially.
You've given us a beginning here, and we appreciate it very much. And the websites are hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com and integrativehbot.com. Dr. Scott Scherer, S-H-E-R-R, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
And finally, running a little over, I understand, but it's important. We've asked Lou Ann Panessi. She is a 40-year practicing oncology nurse, cancer nurse, plus a nurse administrator, and now she, for the last 21 years, she's been a holistic nurse, and she has as much knowledge of ozone therapy as anyone in the United States, and as a result, she knows how it should be done, what it helps, what it doesn't help, and how the right protocols and wrong protocols, because I've seen both. Nice to have you with us, Lou Ann.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me. Yes, I've been working with ozone therapy and studying it for about 20 years now, ever since I was introduced to it from your shows. And ozone is essentially, it's called triatomic oxygen. So it's a highly charged, volatile particle. So what happens is pure medical oxygen is passed through high voltage tubes and creates ozone. O2 becomes O3. So as we just heard, the body needs oxygen, and oxygen has helped in many ways, whether it's pressurizing it or direct push or peroxide therapy. There's all different ways to get ozone in the body. So, and interestingly, Dr. Warburg, a two-time Nobel Prize winner, discovered that if a cell gets less than 60% of the oxygen it needs, it mutates to a cancer cell, and they get their fuel from the body's glucose instead of from oxidation. So it's important to get ozone. Now, here's my concern. There are practitioners that will have people come in. If you're going to get ozone with a practitioner, especially any medical doctor, you want to make sure that they don't, first of all, you don't want anyone to guarantee that this is going to cure everything, because there's no one particular thing that's going to cure everything. It's got to be one piece of an entire protocol, a comprehensive lifestyle protocol combined with the alternative therapies. So the other thing I encourage people to do is always, if you have a virus, because as we just heard, high concentrations of oxygen can kill viruses, HIV viruses, it kills cancer cells, and it does so many other things for the body. It helps with chelation therapy as well. So you want to make sure that you have comprehensive testing done. So if you're being treated for, say, herpes virus, and ozone is very effective against herpes virus if done correctly, I would say make sure that whatever physician you're with, if he's not testing you for every other virus, stay away. Because what's happening is, I had about 9 or 10 different viruses in my body. And if you want to just get rid of herpes 2 and you have 4 or 5 other viruses, the ozone may take care of one virus first, and the herpes will come later on. So we want to make sure that you're getting a comprehensive assessment with a physician, and you want to make sure you're testing for all of your microbes in the body to see how many antibodies your body is struggling to produce. And you want it to be part of a comprehensive, healthy lifestyle protocol.
How many? I need real quick answers to these two. What should ozone cost? Give us a spectrum in the New York tri-state area.
It should cost around, I don't know, between $50 and $60 maximum. Because you just add in the time, the actual time of the practitioner, and the actual cost of the material.
And it takes, what, about 5 to 10 minutes maximum to give a therapy session?
Sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes 15 minutes, and I always encourage people to have something hot to drink to keep the bronchioles open because your baroreceptors will slow everything down. You might feel a tightness in your chest. Hot tea
helps. Okay, so here's the takeaway message. If anyone makes promises of cure, stay away from them. If they don't have a beginning set of tests to determine how well they're doing, stay away from them. If they're charging you more than that, stay away from them. Okay, if people want more information, we're out of time. Can they reach out and you'll answer them?
Surely. My number here is 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198. I'll be happy to answer their questions.
Thank you, Luann. And we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.